And now we're welcoming the first speaker, Steph Walter. Thank you very much.
Hello. So, I'm going to show you Cockpit, a project we've been working on. You can, well, I'm not going to show it. So, here we go. You can see how it looks. There's a networking, storage, some basic stuff on the side that lets you configure systemd, configure network manager, all sorts of stuff on your system. But that's not what I want to show you today. You can go and look at this anytime. Simple, yum install cockpit, apt-get install cockpit. What's really cool about Cockpit is that it's a real Linux session. You have sessions over SSH, the terminal. You have X11 Wayland sessions that bring up a whole desktop. This is an actual session in your web browser. You haven't seen something like this before. You can see that it actually registers with a real user. It logs in with a real user ID, registers with systemd as a real session. Here are the processes that are running in the session, some parts of Cockpit. Obviously, this less process here that's showing this. We have a real SE Linux session. I'm going to pause that. A real SE Linux session. All the different kinds of sessions, PAM, stack, and so on. This is an honest thing in your browser, an honest session in your browser. And not only that, the JavaScript code that's running in your browser is part of that Linux session. So here you can see we're typing JavaScript code in the JavaScript console of the browser, and we're accessing Dbus as a real honest Linux session. All of the UI up there is implemented in this way. So look, here's a proxy. We're accessing properties on that proxy. We're going to call a method on that proxy, set static hostname. Here we go, and call it marmalade. And look up there. As we do this, you'll see the system actually changes in real time. This is a real call to hostname D, part of systemd. And this repeats over and over again. Any part of the system that you want, you can access it from JavaScript directly. Let's skip ahead. Let's try to skip ahead. So, it's also trivial to build stuff. Because of that, in your browser, using HTML and JavaScript, build UI. You don't need to build a big REST API or anything to communicate with the system and carry out your actions there. You can just go and do it. I'm copying some files. And making them available in Cockpit. I'll log in again. Cockpit is always branded as the operating system, whether it's Fedora or Debian or CentOS. But here we see we've built a new thing that lets us export an NFS pass, share files on the network. And we type something, we click export. Let's see how it works first, and then I'll show you how it's implemented. So here we go. We actually exported /MNT. But the plugin's not complete. It didn't show us any nice information up there, just did what we said. So here's the code, and we're going to modify this. We're going to complete this. Up here is a form, standard HTML. That's where we type the path. This is the button that we bonk to make our things happen. We execute this run function when the button is clicked, and we spawn a process, exportfs, with the path. We actually put the super user option here, run it as sudo. If the user has privilege to escalate, access to escalate privileges, that happens. But let's watch your file now. I'm going to skip ahead slightly. Skip past all the spelling mistakes. So we're watching a certain file for changes on the system. That was just one line of code, and it says whenever that file changes, run this changed function. Clear the output box and replace it with the output of this command. Let's skip ahead again. And call this display function when it does. I'm copying the files up again to the system, refreshing the browser, and you can see instantly there's changes here. As we type stuff in the box, things update, and when we do stuff from the command line, similar actions, the UI changes. So, This is amazingly powerful, amazingly trivial and simple, and it's a new Linux session that you guys can hack on really trivially if you want, and build the equivalent of shell scripts, but in a GUI, in a powerful way. See you guys.
So my talk would be about running GNOME in the cloud. So you know that GNOME can run on your desktops, on your laptops, but it is also possible to run it on servers. Let me actually go to one of such servers now. And present from there. So while it's authenticating, okay, it's authenticated, I am there. So you see it's running on Amazon, it's running GNOME, and why would this be useful? This is useful, for example, for giving remote training sessions. So I work for NobleProg. They are specialized in giving remote training courses. And unlike cheap remote training courses, we don't just do a webcast. We do a real interactive session where both participants, both the trainer and the trainee, can interact with a shared screen. And it's useful to have such shared screen in the cloud because it means zero setup, zero possibility of mistake, of dissatisfaction because the customer didn't set up something correctly on their computer. We usually host such shared screen on Amazon, just like I did for this demo, or in LXC containers on our hardware. And this creates some challenges. Namely, there is no display attached to the server, so we have to use some display, remote display protocol like VNC and sometimes even no GPU. But no GPU is not really a problem because Xorg, the normal Xorg server with the dummy video driver and void input driver works very well with GNOME. It's several releases. It was several releases before when the GNOME shell was defaulting to LLVM pipe if a real GPU is not available, and it works very well now. However, VNC in itself provides another problem because our target audience usually does not run GNOME and does not run Linux at all. Many of our customers use Windows. And there is a really big zoo of VNC servers and clients available, and they all implement different extensions and they have a huge interoperability problem. For example, it's a really small problem that real VNC and all others implement very differently how they efficiently transport compressed images so that they don't use up all the bandwidth. There are three non-interoperable encryption protocols. So, and sometimes a client just can't connect to a server, especially if the server runs real VNC or if the client is real VNC. So the common denominator is a basic non-encrypted connection, which is not what I would call a really usable situation when everyone can snoop on our keystrokes and look at our screen if they work at the ISP. So using raw VNC is not a good solution. So we install so-called NoVNC, which is an HTML5 VNC client, which is what I use for this demonstration. It is based on Canvas and WebSockets. It connects to Vino, which is running in the GNOME session. Unfortunately, there is one line bug fix. required for interoperability, but it is a no VNC bug. And you see that the session is encrypted, and encryption is based on TLS standard, and it works for all our customers. That's all.
Thanks. So now we have a very, very special guest who represents the young generation who is coming to GUADEC, to this GUADEC, thanks to us being, thanks to this conference being so friendly and open to them, I think, as part. And I'm very proud that she's doing a lightning talk today. And I'm handing over the stage to Eleanor Blandford now.
Now. Well, maybe this will work.
My name is Eleanor Blandford, and I live in California. I am 10 years old, and I want to learn how to program. At school, we do computer classes, but they are mostly like typing and math games. I've seen like two coding games at school, and one at home, but not all of them are good. I want to learn to code because I learned how to make something cool and finish the game that my dad and I started to do. I tried to use Learn to Code websites to help myself learn and understand it more. These three websites did not work for me, and I'm going to tell you why. The first one I tried was code.org. It was pretty fun, but it uses those blocks up there, and you learn about how to make the programs, but you don't actually learn how to code the actions. And the second one I did was Scratch. It also uses blocks. It is a lot more complicated because there are blocks, instead of blocks like turn right, there are blocks like if blank is touching blank, do blank, and you learn a lot more about the layout of the program, but it's still, but you still have to learn how to actually write the code. I really want to learn how to make my own actions. The third one I tried was Code Combat. It does not use blocks, but it really didn't work for me because it just doesn't feel like coding. There are 7 or 8 worlds and around 75 levels in each world. There are a lot of different weapons and armor and things to kill monsters and a whole multiplayer option where you can join a clan. So it's a lot of distractions for coding, and it feels more like a classic video game because it has the same objectives of one: beat the levels, unlock the treasure, get all the cool stuff. Also, most people, when playing, they just type left or move left and click the formal code in the drop-down bar, so you usually don't learn a lot of code anyway. So none of those websites actually taught me how to code. They were all pretty fun. In code.org, you can make a Flappy Bird clone and play with it for a little while. I still didn't learn that much. I haven't learned to write a program from scratch. It would be great if anyone could find some better way than these websites for me and other children who are interested to learn how to program the computer. Thank you for listening. Does anybody have any questions?
Thank you so much. So if we do have questions, do you have any contact details? It's probably best to approach her in person if you do have any questions. Okay. Now, I am doing a lightning talk as well. Please start the timer. Thank you so much. So, this is actually two lightning talks, very, very compressed. So first, I have to do my annual Koala lightning talk. There's no way to go around this. So the Koala project has evolved a lot. By now, we have seen over 120 different contributors. And the project really, really grows well, and I'm very, very proud of it. For many people, the question, what is Koala, actually, is still an open question. Because during the last years, I wasn't very good at explaining it. Actually, I partly didn't know it, actually. So what Koala is today? Koala is a program that finds problems in your source code, and it can also fix them. So traditionally, you have all those tools for different programming languages. And whenever you want to write new code analysis, you have to write a completely new tool, which just sucks because it's just a new tool, a new user interface, more frustration for the user, and more work for you. I mean, what you rewrite LibreOffice, if you want to have spell checking for Spanish, would you really do that? I think not. And I think we are doing this in the world of static code analysis, and we shouldn't do that. So Koala is one API, and Koala has already wrappers for many existing tools, so you can reuse existing code analysis functionality. We have no intent of rewriting this because that's redundancy again. But Koala is sustainable. It allows you to create new code analysis from scratch without writing a new tool. You just write a routine for this API, and it works right ahead. And then you get all of those neat interfaces for free. You can work with JSON. You can get your GitHub pull requests automatically reviewed. You can have something for continuous integration, and so on, and so on, and so on. So as a user, you have a unified interfaces for all your programming languages that you use. Actually, at the moment, we support 55 programming languages. And every time I present this, I have to update this slide. So very, very quick peek on how you configure Koala. It's an ini-like configuration. You can also give command line arguments and generate it. And you just tell it, for C, I want those checks to happen. For Python, I want those checks to happen. And then you can also give additional settings. If you just run Koala with a config file, which is like a make file automatically picked up in that directory, Koala will automatically check all your sections. You can also run Koala C to only check your C code. And that's essentially how it looks. It tells you there's something wrong, and this is how you can fix it. And I have to stop here because my second lightning talk is running out of time. So the second lightning talk is about a video. And it was an idea we had at EuroPython. And we were like, hey, let's do a video. We have 6 hours of time. We have no experience. We have no good cameras. Let's just do it. And that's it. Oh yes, it was a lot of fun. And it was a Python conference.
Well, when I first met Leon, his coding style was really bad. And when I say bad, I mean like really bad. Well, I guess at some point you just couldn't stand it anymore.
Oh, fuck it!
Yeah, he was really pissed. But little did you know, but we were working on a tool that would change his life forever. Equipped with Koala, Udayan was able to take on the world to the box. Cheers.
I don't know where you are, I don't know why you're here. I can tell you. I don't have a lot of patience, but what I do have are a particular set of tools. Tools I've acquired over a large number of comets. Tools that make me a nightmare for bugs like you. I will look for you, I will find you, and I will fix you.
Thank you very much. And now it's Bastian Ilso.
Thank you. Okay. Okay, so I'll be talking a little bit about something I looked into in relation to making the streaming artwork for Guadec, which I guess probably right now mostly the people who are watching in the live stream is noticing. It's the way you make those streaming artworks is about like you make stuff in an SVG file, and then this is an example of how the SVG looks like when you open it in a text editor. Usually, in my case, I did that in Inkscape. But when you then have to do the animation, you write a Python script and then it exports PNG files to via Inkscape to do that. And that's using this tool here, the FRAP-based intro and outro generator that the CCC team has made, and it's really awesome. So the way it works is that you have the XML schedule. So we made an XML schedule. Well, Benjamin made an XML schedule. And then you have the Python script and then this artwork. And then you can generate video files that makes like intros for all the talks. So everyone who've talked at this Guadec will have like a personal animation with their name flying. And pew. I think I have a video here, something like that. I think that was from a different conference, but that's an example. So one thing that's interesting and important to know when animating SVG is that HTML elements, they have their origin inside the center. And then when you are working with, for example, a rectangle in SVG, your coordinate system starts in the upper left corner. So that means that the scaling also works a bit differently, and then you need to use something called the chain transform functions, which I was not familiar with, and that meant that I had some very funny animations to start with, especially when trying to scaling or rotating anything. So essentially you combine different transforms, and then you create this chain, and that gives the final look of the coordinate origin changing. So that was the end result. This is an animation on the end of all the Guadec talks, just a zooming logo and then fading out. And this is all lovely. The way you can kind of do this is you can figure out the position of the logo, and then you position it where the SVG has its origin. In Inkscape, that's the y-axis is inversed, so that's kind of odd. But other than that, it should work. And then you do the scaling, and then you can move it back in its place. But in reality, you have, if you made the artwork in Inkscape, probably more something like this. So it's not as clean as I just showed. So yeah, and then the Inkscape default coordinate system is the other way around, so you have to take that into account. So you get stuff like that instead, if you're not careful, really. So I ended up doing something like adding a black square up here, and then I could use the align tools to center it up there, and then do the actual transformations, because I found out that as long as you have your complex object inside a group, and then you group it again, then you don't have to think about all the weird matrices that Inkscape have applied to the objects inside the group. But yeah, that's the SVG transforms. I think it's looping now. No, this is the Python script. So that's to give you an idea about how it works. Basically, you are putting IDs on objects, and then you are changing properties of the object, and then you can use some easing functions to make it look nice and all. And then there's this Python script that generates it all, and then you get these .ts files for every single talk. And that was all.
Okay. So, well, I'm one-handed. Okay, so I was going to stand up here and talk to you guys about a documentation site generator called Pentail. Pentail's really awesome, and you should check it out anyway. But I ended up doing a non-conference session about it, so I'm not actually going to do that, although I'm still throwing a few balls. I think, actually, most people were in here talking to Cosmo about privacy. Did that go well? Good. All right, good. I'm glad you guys talked to Cosmo instead of me. But since I got 5 minutes... we've been trying to put together a web page to acknowledge and thank the people who have won pants over the many, many years. I'm astounded this doesn't exist. And we're trying to fill in some gaps, so I'm going to crowdsource some information. So what I know is that this year, here in Karlsruhe, it went to Alex. Is Alex here? 5 seconds of clapping. I don't have much time. Stop. Okay, last year in Gothenburg, it went to Emily. She's not here. Before that, Strasbourg, it went to Alexandra. Alexandra? 5 seconds. 2013 in Brno, it went to Alan Day. Alan? Before that, 2012 in A Coruña, it went to Marina. Marina? 2011 in Berlin, it went to Matthias. 2010 in The Hague, it went to Gil and Sylvia. They're not here. 2009 in Gran Canaria, it went to Owen Taylor. 2008 in Istanbul. Who got the pants? Olaf? Olaf, 5 seconds. 2007 in Birmingham. It went to Federico. Yes? Am I right? 2006 in Villanova. It went to Elijah and Vincent. I don't think either of them are here. 2005 in Stuttgart. Who got the pants? Nobody knows. Who? I don't know. 2004 in Kristiansand. Anyone know? I'm putting this into your head and go home and think about it and then email the board and let us know. We really want to get this. 2003 in Dublin. Was that, did Jeff get it in Dublin? That would be the beginning, whenever Jeff got it. Lewis in 2004? And Christensen? All right, I'm asking. That's fine, but I found out that Olaf got it in 2008 in Istanbul, so my list is slightly more complete. Okay, if anybody knows any more, email board list and let us know. We'd really like to get a page up to, you know, have this bit of history so we don't lose it all. Thank you.
Okay. This is on. All right. Hi, everyone. Jeff and I are going to talk about the making of the annual report, and I'm going to go first. So the annual report is not just a cool collectible that you guys collect every year at GUADEC. It's also an important tool that for us, because it helps keep the line of communication open between the foundation administration and our funders and also the potential funders. So with that, we also, when we make it, we have to determine the right kind of content and message that we want to put inside, as this is our opportunity to tell our stories and accomplishments to the funders and potential funders, for example, like this. And what do we need to make an annual report? We definitely need people who are willing to write content for the report. So we are grateful for the regulars who always contribute, but newcomers, you are welcome to volunteer to try. And the other thing that we really need is photos, lots and lots of them, because we can surely benefit from having plenty and a variety to choose from. So if you have them, please share with the engagement team the URL with of your photo sharing site and indicate your licenses. And Jeff's going to continue with the design and layout.
Thank you very much. Right. So I'm going to talk really fast. The fact that you have the annual report in your hands at Guadic this year was made possible because we started much earlier this year. And it all started with an email from Adelia in January. So I didn't even have to read the full email. I was just reading the intro line and was like, oh, wow, we have new people around. This is awesome. Let's do it. Let's go, 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 go. Right. So today... All right, so today our computer screens are all widescreen, so I propose that we try a landscape design. I also wanted it to be more legible, and both on screen and on print, so I picked fonts especially for this purpose. And we also happen to have more contents to fit in 20% less pages. So all in all, I think we've never had such a drastic change in years, and I'm not sure we spent so much time working on a report like this in the past, because, I mean, we spent 5 to 6 months working on this thing, which is a fair amount of time. As you can see, I started getting serious about the design around the beginning of June and ended somewhere near the end of July, in time to get it to the printer so I could bring them with me in my luggage. Now, sometimes you have to try various things and start over. I wanted to take this opportunity to show you a few things that you did not see in the final version that you have in your hands, because we decided to cut them out. Chart number one, this is a sign key chart, and this was the initial concept I had in mind for the financial report. I still think it's awesome, but the problem is that sometimes it's a bit hard to understand when you're not used to it. And this is a second iteration of the financial chart, much more traditional. I still try to do something different and meld it into the financial table with connector lines instead of just using a legend. In the end, we threw away the connectors line and used a legend in the table. I don't quite remember why, but I'm just talking really quick. And of course, I also tried to put in some jokes in the annual reports timeline, and it almost made it to the final version, but then Zana made me stop. Let's talk about typography. And some of the details you might, sorry, fellow designers, some of the details you might notice only if you examine the annual report fairly closely. When you see the final product, you think, hey, that looks neat, and things fall into place pretty nicely. What a coincidence. There is no such thing as a coincidence. When it comes to layout, I aim to make a perfect balance of alignments and all that stuff. I arrange every paragraph, every line to fit and maintain harmony. We edit the articles to a specific length to fit the available space, and as you have constraints such as the number of pages absolutely needs to be a multiple of 4. Otherwise, it just doesn't work. And the ordering needs to be thought out for when the booklet is open. So print design. That's what I do. It's super fun. You might have noticed that the text is slightly justified everywhere. Right? It's mostly justified everywhere. But there are no big white spaces between the words. That's because I use a combination of techniques to avoid this problem. Damn it. Some places use hyphenation and hyphens and flow and all that sort of stuff. Sometimes I compress the paragraphs, the line spaces, the character spacing, and all that stuff. Anyway, it's easier to spot if you look closely, but this has a bunch of hacks like 1 point less for the line spacing, smaller fonts, and all that. Yeah. Just remember, the annual report is not just a piece of art. It's also a tool that you can have people convinced to help the foundation. So use it.
Thanks. Alberto. So we have one last lightning talk.
I have no slides, so this is going to be really quick. So I wanted to talk about the effort I did to get some ARM hardware for the community. I don't want to talk too much about the hardware itself, more about the process and how I got it, and the power of the GNOME brand. So basically, I wrote a blog post giving some rationale and doing a call for help. And soon after my blog post got out and my Google Plus post got out, I started getting offers for help from individuals, people who worked at a data center saying, if you want to send me hardware, I'm happy to plug it somewhere in here, and you'll have network access. And then I had people willing to spend pocket money on buying us single board computers, Raspberry Pis. At the same time, people from Canonical got in touch with Qualcomm, and they managed to secure us 4 Dragon boards. These are like, I think, $75 boards. They're 64-bit. They run a Qualcomm GPU, which means it has a free driver. You can run GNOME Shell on these ones with no problem. And soon after, we got in touch with Andrew Wafa from ARM, and they secured us a blade that we sent to Phoenix with the rest of the GNOME infrastructure. They were super responsive, super quick. And I also got a call from CodeThink offering us space, a few slices of their Moonshot, which is a huge and expensive HP ARM server with a lot of CPUs. The reason I wanted to tell you about this is I was amazed by the response from the wider community outside of the people from this room. I was overwhelmed by the people willing to spend pocket money sending us hardware if it was needed. I did write a blog in my post on my blog thanking all the people who did offers. But what I wanted to say is, if you think GNOME needs infrastructure help in any specific areas, don't be shy. Coordinate with the engagement team, and we can try to reach out to those companies. You will be surprised at the amount of stuff we can get for free just by piggybacking on the GNOME brand. I was blown away by the amount of stuff. I mean, we got an excess of $3,000-$4,000 in hardware. Oh, and the other company that got in touch with us was Banana Pi, and they sent us 6 boards with different configurations. These are really neat. They can run Fedora. The problem is the GPUs they don't have free drivers, so we cannot run GNOME Shell on these ones yet. But if anyone is interested in reverse engineering the Mali stuff, please request for one of these. And if anyone has any projects where they think they can improve the support of GNOME in ARM and they think these boards will be useful for them, please get in touch with me. And I think that's it. I have a minute and a half for questions. Go for it. I'll repeat it. DigitalOcean, yeah. Oh, I did get in touch with Scaleway, which are a similar provider than DigitalOcean. They have ARM servers, but they run out of stock of the ARM boards. They have a limited set of ARM boards on their racks. There's a lot of people who want to do server-side stuff, and we're always talking about how we're limited in bandwidth. So I think there's room for us reaching out to Rackspace, DigitalOcean, Scaleway, and trying to get some resources from them. And you can cross compile as well. And we can, that's another approach. But. Any other questions? We have 30 seconds. It's now or never. There you go. Next.
Thank you. Okay. So that was the lightning talk session. I have 2 things to say. We do have one Lenovo power adapter in the lost and found box. Okay, that goes there. Great. And then we have a very weird USB cable, which actually has a name, but I forgot it, but I just couldn't remember it. So it has a USB on the one side and a very small one on the other side, which is weird. Fitbit, whatever. I don't know. So if it's yours, come to me or somewhere. Okay, great. And then, from my side, many, many thanks to the great speakers, to the lightning talks, and now we can close the conference with the actual people who can close the conference.